Learning as a Developer with Charles Flatt.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host. Make sure to check out www.azuredevops.show for past episodes and show notes. And the goal of this podcast is to empower you and your teams with the information that you need to move fast and deliver consistent quality using the whole .NET ecosystem, and also to run your software systems with confidence in Azure. And for those of you running .NET and Azure user groups, I've been doing a lot of online video presentations. And if you run one of those groups, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Our sponsor and my employer, ClearMeasure, is a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver true world-class results. And so if you think we can help, please get in touch. And if you are a .NET developer and would like a path to become an architect, we are hiring. Just apply on the website, clearmeasure.com, and there are several positions still open at the time of this recording. Charles Flatt is here with us on the DevOps podcast, and he's been a software developer since 1994. He's helped over a dozen organizations succeed on over 50 projects, small and large. And he has an unusual breadth of business and personal experience, and I'm excited to have him here on the show to talk about his learning and some of his successes. So, Charles, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Awesome. Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. You've had over two and a half decades of experience. And with the growth of our industry, there's, I think I saw some stats that 50%, we've doubled our industry in the last 7 years. So 50% of the people writing code today were not even in the industry 7 years ago, much less, 25 years ago. So you've seen a lot, and I'm excited to kind of share some of that with the audience there. But how do we even begin starting on how you got your career started?
Yeah. So prior to my career in software, I had careers in food service and retail, and I went to school back when I still had a pet pteranodon at the College Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati, and that was with a major in music, violin performance. So that was going to be my career path, was in music, and it turned out that wasn't going to be a good match for me. So I went into English, and then it turned out that college wasn't a good match for me. So I went into the workforce, and really, then in 94, after working and moving and doing some and also working in management in business, mostly in retail, then that's when I got really interested while I was working at Walden Books, which some people may remember. I got really interested in more in the computer side. I had a couple of friends who worked for GE and said that they thought I might be good at it. And so that's when I looked into it and decided just to take the plunge and started teach myself and got my first computer, financed it with a credit card. And a couple, 3 years later, got my first, very, very fortunately, got my first job doing hardware installation for a company in Cincinnati called Kentucky Auto, KOI Auto Parts. So that was really something. They were working on a operating system, the PIC database operating system, which almost no one has heard of, but it still exists. And it originally really was an operating system, but with a NoSQL, essentially, file system underneath. And it's really a beautiful, if you ever get the chance to look at it, it's a really beautiful environment. They also had access to source code, and PIC was, the application was written in a variation of BASIC. So I spent a bunch of time on a green screen doing debugging, line by line debugging, and also starting to do a little bit of programming at that point. And from there, it just went on with writing a help desk software internally for internal use, using Microsoft Access 2000, and then getting into Visual Basic. And that led me into my first job really as a software developer for a company called, at the time, Global Quality Corporation. Very interesting small business. And we did some really interesting stuff. We actually wrote a order entry system for a company, and used Rockford Lotka's his object, as much object oriented as you could make it at the time, Visual Basic guides as kind of our Bible. And that was very instructive, and we were very successful.
Nice. Yeah, we've had Rocky Lotka as a guest on the show.
He seems like he'd be a really interesting dude, man.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. I still remember it was a few conferences in 2019. One of the conferences, we're at a table and everyone else is partying, and we sat down in the corner. It was Rocky Lotka and myself and Udi Dahan of In Service Bus in particular software, and we were debating about what the proper patterns are for microservices distributed messaging. No, you're not just going to have two or three applications that are communicating with each other. You're going to have lots of them. And how do you do it across the organization? It's just fascinating, fascinating discussion.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So the last decade, what have you been working on the last decade?
Oh gosh. I mostly worked for a company in Cincinnati, I'm going to start losing track here if you start asking me too many questions. It was a background check company, and selection.com. And they had an interesting situation. They provide background check services to organizations all across the country, large and small. And that's a far more complex environment than you might expect. And it was, when I came in, they only had a team of three, and that was two developers and one IT guy. And they hired me to try to try to give them some breathing space to work on an internal application that really needed to be redone. It was an Access 97 application. So over the course of my time there, we tried to work with that, as well as introducing I and another fellow there, really great developer and manager. Ultimately, he became the CIO of the business. We introduced agile methodologies, really just doing some stand-ups and trying to do more board related work, and that turned out to be very effective for us. They had a very complex, they had a lot of source code. They just had a lot of stuff because they did a lot of integrations and so forth. So I worked for them, and then I left because I was really searching for what matters to me. What's the meaning? What am I going to do that's satisfying? Not just making money. And, that's when I took some time away and ultimately ended up working for a school in Cincinnati called Hillcrest Academy, part of the Rite of Passage group of schools. And what Rite of Passage is focused on and interested in is helping boys and girls, in this case in Cincinnati, it was boys at Hillcrest, who are going through criminal justice. It's basically boys who were... this was boys who they have to go to school because they're underage, and they're either going to do it in prison or in a beautiful campus with supervision. And I signed on to be the only network person there. And that was something that I wish that I had been able to, a part of me wishes I'd been able to keep doing, but it became too much for me. But it was incredibly inspiring to see the teachers there who were just so devoted, the staff who were giving these boys the best chance they could get. And the boys themselves, who knowing the stats on that, knowing that most of them were going to end up back where they started from, but many weren't. And it was going to be because of the effort that was put in. Mm-hmm. And hearing a boy up on stage say, as he's graduating, meaning he's moving on to work, to be able to be in a normal school. Mm. That's what graduation there was. Now we're going to send you to a regular school. And to say, I want to thank my grandma for helping raise me. I want to help I want to apologize for those times I got in trouble, for that time I got shot. It's like that transforms a person, because that's mm-hmm. something I will never experience. And yet I could try to help them. So, and then my wife and I moved from Cincinnati to Denver. Love being here. Love the area. I did some contract work for Selection. And at the same time, I was looking for other places to work. Eventually, I got hired on at a company called Globus, Globus Family of Brands. And you may know them from, they do tours. And so if you've ever booked like a cruise or a tour in the United States, they're probably one of the places you would have considered. Terrific, really terrific company. When the pandemic hit, they worked very hard to bring their guests home. And that speaks volumes, I think. So, and for them, I was doing software development and helping them get some of their Agile stuff going better. We did a lot of work with getting their unit testing going, improved unit test coverage, looking at a lot of processes, and also just doing straight development work. So
awesome. That's pretty inspiring. And over your second half or more recent part of your career, you've done so much consulting and professional services. When we talk about helping organizations through over 50 projects, I don't think a lot of programmers know how many 50 projects are. And some programmers who just maybe are a few years into your career, maybe you're on your first or second project, because if you join an IT department, you could have maybe one project per year. And whereas in the consulting world, maybe it's a 6-month project or a 3-month project where you got to make an impact quickly, and then you move to another one. So over that many projects, what are some of the big things that stand out that you've learned that you see that all of these development organizations just need to help figuring out?
Almost without exception, what I've seen is that the organizations typically have culture problems. And often those culture problems are, we know that there are better ways to do things, or we think there are better ways to do things. And yeah, it would be nice to do that if only we had time, or we'll get to that someday. It's usually things along those lines. And what I've seen is that is not solely an issue at the development level, but it's often an issue higher above that. It's at the executive level or at the management level, where the execs and the management, they don't know enough about how software development actually works and what makes it actually successful. Mm-hmm. And so they create situations that make it actually harder for their development teams to sharpen the saw, to use Stephen Covey's terminology, to be able to actually make those improvements. And it's easy to miss, because we have a hard time as developers. We have a hard time explaining. We're just not good at explaining quite what we do and how hard it is. We get it because we do it so much. And so I've been thinking about metaphors. And I think that one way that the people who aren't involved in our field would understand better is to not look at what we do as building a house. Because building a house, as anyone who has been through that, I haven't, but I've heard of it. And building a house, you still work. Usually you go to somebody, unless you're doing a custom home, you go in and say, here are the blueprints that we basically have available. Here's the kinds of houses we build. Okay. I'll take selection D. That looks pretty good. All right. We're experienced with that. And we're going to go by the numbers. even if you build a custom house, there are certain things that are known. We don't build houses. We build cities. Mm. If you wanted to create a city from scratch, imagine what would go into that. Not a 200-person city. If you wanted to have a 300,000 or 400,000 plus person city, what would it take to do that? Infrastructure, communication, government, schools, education, and your requirements are going to change. So the other way to look at it is, what does it take to put together a feature film? It's just astonishing that anyone can do that. Mm-hmm. So looking at it in terms of we're building a city also helps to bring together why we need time, why there needs to be solving of technical debt, why we need to always be improving our processes, why we have to look so hard at those, and how hard it is to measure it. So I would say the other thing is that many organizations are learning averse. They get stuck in the ruts and they think they're learning, but they're not learning as much and applying what they learn. They don't challenge themselves enough. They get stuck in status quo. By challenging yourself and finding out what's going on and seeing what is evidence-based and not just hyperbole, then I think that that is what will lead organizations to better improvement. And that's not just in software development. If you look at the history of business improvement, if you look at what people like Tom Peters, W. Edwards Deming, Peter Drucker, that's older, of course, class of mm-hmm. business leaders and newer ones as well. Or if you look at what happened in our field with the Agile Manifesto, I was just rereading the other day. Mm-hmm. What you see are people who really treat what they do as scientists and see it as an experiment and ask not what's the thing that's going to do that's going to just make everything better, but what's the thing that there's evidence that we can support, evidence that this will work, and then let's try it. And then we'll learn from it, and then we'll go back and cycle. Even developers still have trouble with that. Developers, strangely, are the ones sometimes who fight against implementing Scrum or Kanban or Lean or some of these things, and which always, frankly, always puzzles me, because it was developers who created those things to make mm-hmm. their jobs better.
Right.
So I think I think being a learning culture is really important for an organization, and to understand what that means, and a measuring culture. You got to be able to measure what you're doing. That's not to say that it's not true that you can't improve if you don't measure. That's just not true. And Deming never said that. Actually, he said kind of the opposite. If you get too stuck in measurement, then you're going to run into troubles, because he didn't like management by numbers. But mm-hmm. measurement is also often often what's missing in people finding out if they're changing or improving. And to bring this full circle into how to help, this is why in DevOps, the work of, say, the DORA group, the DevOps Research and Assessment Group, is so valuable. The book that's, I think everyone should read, should be required reading, one of them is Accelerate by Dr. Forsgren, mm-hmm. etc. Because it's real science. I know that the Phoenix Project is another book out there that looks at that. And let's give you a plug. I know that your book on DevOps is also also very good implementation of that, and I have read that. So at least I've read most of it. I've read the good parts, which I guess is all of it. But
yeah, nobody needs to read every word, because there's lots that they probably already know. Well, yeah, the Phoenix Project, at least from my understanding, there's a 3-book series, the Phoenix Project, and then that same author group created the yellow book, the DevOps Handbook, and then mm-hmm. the gray book, Accelerate. Seems like they're all in the same circle of people.
They are, because they came out of the DORA group, or are actually still mm-hmm. a part of it. Accelerate is fascinating because it dives into not only what the capabilities are that organizations need, but also talks about all the research and the math and the science behind that. So it's not just an opinion. so many business books, so many business articles, so many, I mean, shoot, the stuff I write on my own podcast, on my own blog, you know, it's like, that's my opinion of the day. This is not guesswork. Mm-hmm. If you do these things, you will improve.
Right.
You may need to make some adjustments, but they give you also ways to measure. And I think that organizations can really take advantage of that. But it takes courage in many ways. It takes courage on the part of the employees and on the part of management to say, I don't know everything and I'm going to have to change. That's what executives and management are prepared for. It's not, you guys are going to need to change. Yeah, you go to make that better. It's, I'm going to have to change. John Doerr makes that explicit in Measure What Matters.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Well, there's so many facets of what might need to change. Tooling is what product companies tend to sell. Oh, just buy this tool because you want to move faster or you want to have better quality. But do most teams need better tools, or do they need to think about things differently?
The second one. Yeah, tooling is important, but process and understanding process and how to know you're getting better, how to learn, how to practice, how to support each other, how to have a team that works well together. Those are the things that really work against most organizations that I see, or work for them when they're working well. There's a lot less guesswork because these are really important topics that companies who have way more money than us have actually spent time on. Google with its research into teams and teamwork, and what are the five, and I can't tell you what they are, but what are the five qualities of successful teams, not what were expected. And a lot of it is psychological safety, the ability to bring up problems, to have a certain level of respect, even if you don't agree. How do you do that? Which nicely parallels what's happening in the positive psychology world and also in cognitive behavior therapy on how do we listen and talk and ask better questions without getting caught up in who's right and who's wrong. So,
okay. So I can hear the future listener kind of listening to this and say, okay, I get it. You convinced me. I need to work on this. Now, what do I do concretely? What do I need to be doing? I'm in a small team. They're eager to kind of learn and break preconceptions and get better. What can they latch onto?
I think that if you want to start implementing both DevOps and better, if you want to start implementing, this isn't even DevOps. If you want to start actually making an improvement, if you don't have solid continuous integration in place, that's a great place to start. So continuous integration, and look at the Doerr Group's four metrics for high performing teams, which are, I'm not going to get them all, but it's things like how many post release failures are you having? How long is it taking you to recover from those? There's two others, but people can look it up. But those four metrics help guide what you're doing. Continuous integration reveals so many other issues that you might be having. Because to make even continuous integration succeed, and it requires improving automated testing, and that includes unit testing as well as automated integration testing. It looks at things like tooling. It requires understanding better your source control. And it means working with management in order to say, we have to build time in to do this, which is automatically going to start asking, you start asking, well, what does that mean for us in terms of how we manage our projects? I would say that as an aside, it's astonishing how many companies who have ways of managing projects or are project-based companies, like ClearMeasure is, who, when they go to do their internal projects, when they want to make improvements to themselves, don't follow their the process that they use for all their clients. You got to follow the same process.
Yeah.
You need to do that because that's you've shown that that works. So you want to improve your, you want to make continuous integration a thing, put it on your backlog, put it in your, on your board, treat it exactly the same way. Make sure it shows up in your planning and that the execs know that what time that's, you know, what that's taking.
So I quickly looked up how the Accelerate book frames those four metrics that they use the terms lead time for changes, development, deployment frequency, then time to restore service, and then change failure rate.
Yeah. And all of those are, can be challenging. They have their own challenges in how you measure them. Azure DevOps does have a fair amount of help with that. What they refer to as, for the listeners, what they refer to as lead time for changes. Is that what it was? It's really cycle time. It's the time between you start working on something and you finish it. Lead time traditionally is when something was requested and how long it takes. So
yeah, if it just sits there.
Where I've seen that implemented is, and the way I've tried to do that in at least one organization was looking, you can say that the failure rate is how many bugs are going, how many bugs are being reported or are we finding after release, not during development. That's not a good metric. But after release is the mean time to recover. How long is it taking us to correct the critical bugs? And then you have to designate what those are. So that's mean time to recover. And then cycle time, we covered there. And what's the fourth one?
deployment frequency, just the amount of the
deployment frequency. Which, in this particular organization, they had a fixed 2-week cycle of deployment. And that they wanted to try to move to being able to do things continuously. That gets into continuous deployment. I don't think you should be facing continuous deployment until you can have a solid continuous integration system. So that's what I would recommend. Continuous integration, because it will drive so many other things. And from there, usually, I think that it's going to lead to looking at unit testing. And that there's a lot of time involved in going back and trying to deal with that and rework it. I understand the pain of that.
So these four metrics, there's so many metrics that can be debatable. Like people talk about code coverage or bugs in development or estimates. But with these four metrics, I can imagine that every manager would be happy if the lead time for changes was relatively short and stable. Deployment frequency was not longer than they wanted it to be. The time to restore services was very quick, or, you know, the service is not going down very often. And the change failure rate was very, very low. If those four things, if those four metrics were good, it doesn't leave a lot of room for other bad things to be happening. That would be a pretty good development organization.
There's a really good reason that the Dora Group has settled on those metrics, because they've seen that because they would agree with you. And they have plenty of evidence to agree. Yeah, absolutely. It's like if somebody else is going to do the work on what are good metrics for me to use, and they've also provided the evidence, it's like that I don't need to think about it anymore. I can implement that.
Yeah. And continuous integration really does help with this. Even before the word DevOps was coined in 2010, continuous integration was a practice that people were adopting in 2004, 2005, the old truth control software. And but I encounter so many developers now who have never read up on what the practice of continuous integration is. That I mean, there was a book in 2006 titled Continuous Integration, and it's got three phases. It's got the private build, It has the commit stage, which has the integration build, and then it has the first deployment where you run test suites that have to be run on a fully deployed instance of the software. And today, maybe because of the tool vendors, I hear people saying, oh, we have continuous integration in place, but they only have part of step two, where they have an automatically triggered integration build that doesn't run multiple levels of test automation. So it's really just an automatically triggered compilation process. And they think, oh, I have continuous integration in place, but they really don't yet.
Yeah. You know, and really I have to say that when I've checked out some of your other videos and podcasts, and when you went through that and I looked at that, I thought there's a lot of value there, especially in how to think about what it means to do continuous integration. And it's easy to kind of skip the, and as I've done, say, I should have a script that I can just run that just runs locally. And it doesn't just run a few tests. I mean, I can run tests, of course, but having a script that actually will tear down and rebuild to some degree my environment before I push up, I think is pretty darn smart. Because I'm doing first what the automated system is going to do. I've found that not every developer realizes that all continuous integration is writing a script that does what you would do manually. And it becomes more complex than that. But I always, whenever I try to teach it, I say that's all it really is. It's exactly what you would do if you were doing it yourself. If you needed to write a continuous integration server, here's how you would do it. You would write scripts for doing that. And then you would ask the next question, well, how can I offload that? And how can I put an interface on it? This is what you would do. But you're right. I think that doing those things and having some of that deployment, it's the Deming idea of build quality in early. And that's what so many organizations still don't do it for the sake of expediency. And then they realize years later that they're wondering why they're not able to adjust rapidly and why they're behind their competition.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation for me. For the listeners who want to kind of dig in and say, okay, hey, I want to do this, are there any go-to resources that you would recommend they latch onto next?
Yeah, well, we've mentioned some, which is Accelerate, certainly. I would say that not just because you're the one interviewing me, but I think that Clear Measure is actually a good resource because this is part of what you guys do. So there you have actually a wealth of information and walkthroughs, including, and I don't remember which one it is, Jeffrey, but you have like a 10-minute step through of taking an application, I think even building it,
zero to production.
And it's really, that is just, I loved that. And the reason I loved it is because it went really fast. I was already familiar with a lot of the technology, but I could see why things, you know, worked and where some of the value was. So I would say Accelerate certainly is one, or Phoenix Project. I haven't read it yet, but I understand that that's also a really good resource. Start looking into how you do continuous integration, whatever tooling you want to use. And for other improvement things, look into how to learn. Really just start researching how to learn. And habit improvement is a good part of that. So Wendy Wood's book, Good Habits, Bad Habits, is really a tremendous book that would help not only with personal habits, but also applying that to an organization. How do we reduce friction for doing the things the right way, a better way?
Awesome. Well, Charles, thanks so much for coming on the show. This is a fantastic interview. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on.
And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.